Ajahn Chah used to describe it like a person who's had a rope tied around their neck with two strong men pulling it tight. Ever since they were born, every moment of their life, daytime, nighttime, in sleep or wake, being choked. However, they've got used to this. They think it's normal. I think everyone has got this choking feeling. And then one day, these two men loosen their grip, and the string is taken off the throat. Wow, I can breathe. Ah, oh, bliss. That's the bliss of this first jhana. You've been relieved of a burden. The mind is no longer choked by these five external senses, no longer burdened by them. It has this wonderful sense of the bliss of freedom. It's why that each one of these jhanas is called vimokas in Pali, like releases, stages of freedom. And that's why that sometimes that monks are given this simile of like being in a prison. And here you're out of prison for a while. You're on sort of compassionate weekend leave. You've got time out. And that's bliss, that's happiness. It is that movement of the mind in the first jhana, which is because there's not yet enough confidence in what you're doing. The mind is not quite used to this. Subverbally, the mind doesn't realize that it doesn't need to hold on so tightly to this very beautiful, blissful feeling. It can just let go of that last bit of movement. The vitakka vichara can disappear only through the increased confidence. When that confidence is given, or just comes, because you can't actually give anything in jhana, when you feel, as it were, at ease, when mind feels at ease in the nimitta, what happens is it doesn't wobble anymore. Just the nimitta firms up and becomes solid as a diamond or as a rock, at which point so the mind experiences the peak of samadhi. Samadhi, in this particular sense, is no movement at all. Complete sustained attention on a single object. A oneness of perception. And the second jhana is indeed a very amazing state. Again, while you're in there, you don't know what's going on. Sorry, when you're in there, you're perfectly aware of what's going on, but you don't know what's going on. The difference between awareness and understanding, knowing. And you come out afterwards, you just realize just how solid the mind was in that state, how rock-like, how immovable. It's a state of one single perception, unmoving, unchanging, not even wobbling, even the slightest. And that single perception is just bliss again. But a bliss of a different order, far more refined, far more blissful, far more delicious. It is the bliss of samadhi. This is like the first true experience of samadhi come to perfection. Samadhi, sustained attention, where the attention is on just a very refined, blissful feeling and doesn't move at all, doesn't change. There's one thing in your mind, this moment, the next moment, the next moment, for hours on end. Very blissful. Eventually it will start to disintegrate, and the mind will start moving again. From second jhana, the mind will, as it were, go to first jhana on its way out of the jhana realms. And only afterwards, when you look back, you'll be able to find out what that was. Later on, if you reflect upon that second jhana and its experience, you'll find that experience of pure samadhi will be tainted just by a little bit of too much excitement of the mind. When we talk about bliss, piti sukha, there's two aspects to it. One is piti, the other is sukha. However, it is just impossible, really, to think that you can find the meaning of these two terms and distinguish what is piti and what is sukha. It's just like two twins who've been hand in hand together, sometimes arm in arm together, sometimes wrapped around each other all the time, so you can't really tell which one is which. Only until one of them disappears. And it's as you maintain that second jhana, sometimes the bliss which you experience will change. Part of it will disappear, the coarser part of it. That is called the piti. And the mind will move into another singleness of perception, which is far more refined than the one before. And because it is not as coarse, you can maintain that singleness of perception for much, much longer. It is just the happiness, the sukha, sort of born of like just peacefulness, of upeka, of equanimity. And again, a very refined happiness, which you cannot imagine until you've actually gone into those stages. All these stages are really weird. If you thought you knew what happiness was, then forget it, mate, until you've been into any of these jhanas. Then you really understand what the human mind can experience. And all these other happinesses of the world become just so, so coarse. And if you wish to get into the fourth jhana, even that happiness of the third jhana, you can allow just to subside. To go into pure stillness and equanimity. Again, very refined states of mind with a completely different type of bliss. And again, a happiness when it's just a complete stillness of attention. In each of these stages, you only really get some idea of what they were when you emerge afterwards. Of each of these stages of meditation, these jhanas, the first one is perhaps the hardest to really discern, because it's like the widest. There's many, many things that you can come in as first jhana. However, you should always know that if it's a stable first jhana, there's no feelings of the body can manifest, no sounds can be heard, except perhaps you get disturbed by a sound. You were in the first jhana, you come out again, but you go back again and there's no sounds for a long, long time. If you're always hearing sounds in the background, that's not first jhana. And the beautiful bliss in the mind, the lack of a doer, the effortlessness of this state, because when there's effort, there's a doer to make that effort. These are some of the signposts of something like first jhana. The second jhana is obviously far more distinct, because no sounds can disturb you at all in this state. And there's this stone-like experience of the mind. It's as if it was impossible to rock or shake at all. You're stuck in this state very pleasantly. No perception or no idea of a doer or of a me, because when you can't do anything, when you can't move, when you can't say anything, when you can't think of anything, when it's just pure consciousness, it's amazing that the idea of self disappears in a very deep way, not a philosophical way, an experiential way. This becomes a really great source of insight for you when you reflect upon it afterwards. But it's only after you emerge from these stages that you can look back and actually find out what they were. But sometimes you've got to be careful, because sometimes when you emerge from these stages, sometimes desire can sort of add a little bit more onto those stages than was truly there, and can subtract some of the things which were there, which you would rather not be there. sometimes because of the desire to attain these stages, you can manufacture them when they're not really there. So be very careful and honest with yourself about these stages. And if you do have any of these experiences, you should really go and talk about it with a competent teacher. Because you can waste a lot of time thinking you've got into a jhana when you haven't. And you can also waste a lot of time thinking you haven't when you have. Especially the world of nimittas. Be very careful that you understand that world. Because sometimes the nimittas can be strange and idiosyncratic. And you don't realize that that is your particular nimitta. Sometimes also you won't see the same nimitta every time. In the same way you won't look at sort of a croissant in the same way every morning. Same way that you won't look at the mind in the same way. Nimittas are exactly the same for every person, but they can appear. What you add on to it, your perceptual apparatus would add something different to it, sometimes every time. Obviously the chances are, because of conditioning, you'll perceive the nimittas in the same way, pretty much the same way. If you start to perceive them as light, then chances are you mostly perceive them as light. But perception isn't that fixed. You can see nimittas in different ways. So be skillful and be able to recognize the important features of nimittas, the important features of jhanas, so you know your way in these areas. You know how to develop the mind. You know how to gain these states, and you know what to do with them afterwards. When you emerge, first thing you should always do is to look back and check on that experience. What was that? Get to know how it felt. Get to understand the type of bliss and its stability and its origin. And also, having checked out the experience itself, as you should do with every meditation, spend some time reviewing everything you did to get into those stages. Find the important triggers which gave rise to those things manifesting. In particular, see what you've let go of. These are states of letting go, states of abandoning, states of freedom from burdens. They're always caused by you letting go of that which is dukkha, that which is a burden, that which is a hindrance, that which is irritating. These are the key, that's the key to these states. And then if someone asks you afterwards, what is this letting go? This is what the letting go is. Exactly what you've been doing. What is the reason for letting go? That bliss which you experience is a reason for letting go. Then you really begin to understand some of these deep aspects of the Buddha's teaching. Has anyone got any questions or comments about what I've said? He's asking, in the first jhana, is some wobbling there? Is that wobbling from the state of bliss or wobbling from the nimitta? Once the first jhana becomes established, the perception of nimitta, of light, would have disappeared, and what you're actually experiencing is bliss. However, these are subtle mind states, so actually sometimes there's not all that much difference between a nimitta and bliss. So only afterwards, when you look back, you can actually understand exactly what you're perceiving. In the realm of the mind, it's far more vague, I suppose you would call it, than in the world of external world. You know, you can't sort of see a brick sort of turning into a bundle of bliss. But, you know, it does work in the mind. You know, the nimittas, the experience of bliss, sometimes it's hardly any difference in that at all. However, with precision, you can find actually what you're experiencing is bliss. Not sort of light. Same experience, but the perception you're putting on it is the important thing. With the wobble, which again, while you're in this state, you won't be experiencing or knowing any wobbling or anything. You'll just be completely overpowered by this bliss. This is really wonderful. This is really nice. Wow. So you won't be saying this, or experienced actually verbalizing this, you'd just be sort of blissed out basically. And only afterwards, when you merge, that's when you see, you know, what actually was going on there. And if when you look back upon that state and you review it, you can see that the bliss there was sort of wobbly a little bit. It was sort of pulsating, it was coming and going, but not completely going. It's beautiful bliss and just a little bit less bliss. You just straight away the mind goes into the middle of the beautiful bliss again. And there's a slight instability after a while, it just comes back in, it goes straight in again. But not while you're doing this. If this is what you're thinking and what you're assessing at the time, this is not the first jhana. All that thinking, all that assessing, all that naming, figuring things out, taking notes, the sort of thing which you do in a university lecture or whatever, that's all gone. It's only afterwards. And this is one of the problems with the first jhana. It's because of that wobble there, it sometimes can be quite a difficult thing to know. The second jhana, when there's absolutely no wobbling at all, a complete sort of one-pointedness of mind, that's so clear. I've often said it's only when you can experience second jhana you know what first jhana is. Could be, yeah, shaking little child trying to walk, that's a good perception of that. Because again, like a child trying to walk, it can walk very easily, but it's got that bit of fear. Lack of, not so much fear, but lack of confidence in that state. And it's not you, it's the mind having that lack of confidence there. That's why in the second jhana, if you look at actually the Pali, they say, they use the word sampasadana, which is one of the qualities of the second jhana. You give full confidence into that that state. So that's what gives the mind solidity. You just sort of completely colourless. When you enter jhanas, do you always enter in order and come out in order? Basically, yes. You have to go through first jhana to get into second jhana to third jhana to fourth jhana. Simply because these are refinements of the mind, and like refining anything, you have to go through the course to get to the more refined. However, sometimes it happens that you go through those lower jhanas very quickly. In other words, it's when a nimitta arises and bliss there, the wobble only lasts a very short time. As you go into the second jhana. And the second jhana there, the piti only lasts a short time. As you, I gave like a simile in the monastery quite a long time ago. It's like, look upon these jhanas as being like four rooms in the house. But you've got to go like in the first room before you can get to the door of the second room, and go to the second room, and the other side of that room is the door to the third room. You have to go to the other side of that room to get to the fourth room. But with these rooms, the floors are just so slippy that you can't walk on them at all. You can't sort of run, you can't build up any momentum inside that house. All you've got to do is you've got to go outside and you've got to charge as fast as you can. Because all your momentum you get outside. And once you get into the first room, if you've got enough momentum in, you slide right through the first room, right through the second room, right through the third room, you get right into the fourth room. But only with what you sort of make outside. Well, sometimes you've not got that much momentum, and just slide and just in the first room you come to a halt there. You can't go into the next room, you can't go back again, you're stuck there. Until, you know, you just slide eventually back out again. But the simile of like sliding means that effort is disappeared there. Will is disappeared. You can't do anything in these states. So you can't go into first jhana and then while in first jhana decide, okay, now I'll get into the second jhana. You can't do that. You know, all this doing, all this willpower, all this disappearing in jhanas. So that's actually how that you enter these stages. The immaterial jhanas is, I have to say I'm not clear on that one at all, because I've already mentioned in an earlier talk that there is some indication that the immaterial jhanas can be accessed separate than the material jhanas. Whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. The usual way is to do it through the material jhanas. In other words, you know, you get to that fourth room and there's a few annexes around the back. So if you really sort of get a lot of momentum up. And very often the momentum you actually have is the same thing I've been teaching during this retreat, about like giving some instructions to your mind, making little resolutions to tell the mind on the outside, go for third jhana. It's amazing just how the mind can actually perform its tasks. You'll actually slide through the jhanas into third jhana and sort of stop there. You put on its own sort of brakes. You tell the mind outside of the jhanas, okay, you're going to aim for sort of the second arupa jhana, so the infinity of space. Give it the push, you give it the instructions, and then see if it goes in there. Those resolutions are very powerful. What you tell the mind outside of jhanas, especially when the mind is very refined. It tends to do what it's told. Does that make sense? That's why you can always play around with some resolutions. Sometimes it's very interesting, because if you're getting on the edge of jhanas, you're getting some nimittas coming up. Sometimes when you've still got a chance to make a resolution, you can actually try making one. I resolve to get into first jhana. If you've had some experience of that in the past or past lives, sometimes that's enough to access that state. You know, because there's an incredible amount of karma, of memory from the past. And if you've been into a jhana state before, that might be enough to get you in there. You're telling the mind, giving it a very... Only when you're sort of at the edge, you're almost in there. That might be just enough to tip you in. Just make the resolution. May I get into the first jhana. Even though you don't know quite what it is, the mind might remember what it is. Mess around with that, because that can sometimes be powerful. Chances are you've been around this area before. Very unlikely this is the first time you've been doing these sorts of things. When you get into first jhana, would it be wise not to make resolutions and to go into other jhanas and then to go slow for a while? Yes, indeed, it's good to go slow for a while. The one of the suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya, the cow simile, like a cow going up to the mountains and grazing a nice pasture there, and then sees another pasture a little bit further on, another mountain, so goes over there. Forgets his way back because he wasn't really used to the first pasture. He's already gone to the second pasture and he gets completely lost, can't even find the first pasture again. And that cow simile the Buddha gave was to show that it's good actually to be familiar with the first jhana before you go into second jhana. However, sometimes it's not up to you. Sometimes that, again, if you keep running at that door, sometimes you just run sort of faster than you ever thought. And you think you're going into first jhana, and you go into another place completely different. And afterwards, you come out afterwards, that was strange, never been there before, what room was that? The important thing is to run at the door. Just see where you get. Anywhere inside the house is pretty neat. Okay. When you go into a jhana, is there any perception of time while you're in the jhana? There's no perception of time while you're in the jhana. The mind is not doing that sort of type of perception anymore. However, if you wish to just enter a jhana for a certain amount of time, if you've got some teaching to do, or you really want to make sure you are there for lunch, then you can actually say to yourself, okay, I will just enter jhana for an hour or something, or I must be out by 11 o'clock. Then in the same way that many of you try that experiment, when you go to bed at night, I'll get up at 5 to 4, you know, 5 minutes before the bell goes. It works. While you're asleep, or even after you made that resolution, are you aware of time? Are you aware of that resolution? Do you keep it in mind all the time, always reminding yourself? It's gone in there, but you can't find it. But then when it gets to 5 to 4, sort of something turns on and wakes you up. In the same way, if you enter a jhana with the previously stated resolution, I will enter a jhana for 1 hour, 15 minutes and 19 seconds, then within a few seconds either way, probably, that you'll sort of come out. If you don't make that resolution, then it really depends on how quickly you charge at that door. And sometimes it can be a long time. Then unfortunately you'll miss your dinner. Yeah? Well, it's the momentum of resolution, the momentum of all the other things you've done, you know, what you've actually basically let go of. The momentum actually which you take into those rooms is like the momentum of letting go. It's a bit of an oxymoron, because momentum is actually doing something and letting go is doing nothing. But it's the best simile I managed to get so far. It's how much you've let go of, how much you're willing to abandon, how much you're shedding. If you keep shedding, letting go, then once you get through the first door and the first jhana, the mind still wants to do that. It just wants to let go of more and more and get deeper and deeper. But that has to be something subverbal, which becomes almost like a habit of the mind, which you don't need to tell it, it just does it by itself. However, that one of the other momentums or causes is the resolutions. You know, because again, what you're doing is you're instructing the mind, you're programming it basically. And the mind's got the two programs, to let go, but also to make sure you come out again at a certain time. So it's, you know, it's this two types of momentum, two types of influence happening there. Is it useful to concentrate on a monotonous sound? Can this become an imitator which ends in jhana? If it really is a monotonous sound, it eventually disappears and gets into silence. And if you are very skillful, the silence can become so peaceful and so blissful. And then the silence disappears and the bliss remains. So that gives you like a general outline into what happens in these states. In particular, you cannot force these states. You just got to allow them to happen naturally. You get out of the way. The thing becomes blissful, whatever the object is, because you completely relax, rest, you don't disturb it at all. Again, Ajahn Chah's simile of being by the lake. These things actually come out, they change, they go through this process only when you're very still. Okay? Okay, next question. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, are there any nimittas without a center and or a boundary? Yes, certainly. Nimittas without a center or a boundary. The boundless nimittas. And again, very often this is just a perception. You put the perception of a boundary on it, but that's not a very useful nimitta. It's much better to have one which hasn't got a boundary. But sort of all visual nimittas will have a center, because that's the way we view visual nimittas. However, if the nimitta is like a feeling, a sensation, that's how you interpret the mind at this stage, as like a very pleasant feeling, then feelings don't have a center, obviously. But if you can somehow bring the feelings in, like concentrate, make them into a ball rather than spread out, you'll find that it's like focusing the rays of the sun with a magnifying glass, the limitless power will become greater. So this is just a way, like when you're focusing on a visual limiter at this stage in the meditation, what you're actually doing is just bringing in the energies and making them strong. That's why in the perception, the center of the limiter does appear to be sort of stronger, more bright. But really all you're doing is focusing the energies in. So there are limiters without centers and all boundaries. Please, anyone want to say anything about that? I think what you're saying is that sometimes that I've been mentioning that the limiters which you perceive as lights can sometimes come and then disappear very quickly. I think you're asking, can it be that a feeling type limiter can appear very quickly? And I think it's true to say yes. In that deep state of the fourth stage, for example, when you're just completely aware of the breath, and something like bliss might come out very quickly, but be very powerful and then disappear again. And be exactly the same as like a light appearing and then going very quickly again. That would be a limiter arising, and a very useful limiter. But whether it's the bliss which you are perceiving or the light which you are perceiving, what you're saying is very true. The important thing is to be able to maintain your attention on that, to stabilize it. And again, I've given the ways of doing that by just going to the previous stage, continuous awareness of the breath, and stabilizing your attention, and being careful not to be doing so much. Just really let these things go and allow the limiter just to be there. Please explain the importance of having faith and confidence in the limiter. Indeed, that sometimes that this faith and confidence in a limiter, whatever you have faith and confidence in, you feel happy to be around. For example, if there was a snake, but you realised it was a very friendly Buddhist snake, it wasn't going to bite you, then you wouldn't mind if it sort of crawled all around here. If I said that was, you know, it's a friend, it always comes in here and it hasn't got any sort of poison in it, then you feel confident in it, and you wouldn't even mind if it sort of caught up in your lap, you know, if it was a friendly snake. If you have faith and confidence in something, you allow yourself to come close to it, and you will absorb into it. And the point is, with the limiter, one of the things is it's very powerful, it's very strange, and so often, like fear and sort of the lack of confidence, is one of the difficulties there, one of the obstacles to being able to keep attention on it. And also, there's a sense of your faith and confidence in the limiter. The limiter is a manifestation of the mind. You're also giving faith and confidence into the mind. What you're actually saying is, mind, you go ahead and do it. Now, I don't need to sort of give the orders. In the same way that you have faith and confidence in the chauffeur who's going to drive you to wherever you're going. You know, have confidence in the driver, that they know the way and they've driven that way before, they're very safe, they're not drunk, they're not going to have a crash, they're not going to get lost. If you have confidence in that driver, then you can just look outside the window and just enjoy the scenery or go and have a sleep if you want. If you haven't got confidence in that driver, you're always checking up on him or her to make sure they're doing the job right. You're always doing work, you're not letting go of the doer. So when you give confidence into the limiter, you're actually allowing yourself to let go.